Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The 2014 murder of Dan Markell didn't just shock Tallahassee. It left a hole in the heart of the city. His name disappeared from the FSU law schedule. His voice no longer filled the classroom, and his boys vanished from daycare drop-off lines and soccer fields, their jerseys no longer carrying the Markell name. All that remained in Tallahassee was his memory and an open murder case. But even that wouldn't stay confined for long. As investigators traced Dan's hitmen, uncovered their ties, and began making arrests, the trail stretched south to Miami, straight into the Adelson family. To the state, it was a conspiracy, cold, calculated, and driven by Donna herself. But that's not the story Donna would tell. She said she wasn't a mastermind at all. She was a grandmother, a wife of more than 50 years, a woman who worked every day at the family's dental practice, and a mother who meddled, yes, but out of love, not out of malice. And the money, the calls, the behavior the state painted as sinister? Donna and her defense team had explanations for all of it. Explanations that would prove her actions had been twisted by the state and repackaged as evidence of malice. Donna was simply a devoted mother, dragged into a nightmare she didn't create, and now blamed for choices she never made. Two stories, two very different versions of Donna Adelson. The prosecution says she conspired a murder. The defense says she was just an overbearing mother. But it's the jurors who have the final say. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is 13th Juror Podcast. Today's episode is Florida versus Donna Adelson. Part 2, The Defense. When Donna Adelson's attorney, Jackie Fulford, stood to face the jury, she didn't deny the obvious. Sure, Donna had said harsh things during her daughter's divorce, and she definitely meddled. But it was the juror's responsibility to draw the line between frustration and criminal intent. Donna's story, Fulford said, wasn't one of murder, it was one of spin. Emails and texts twisted into a narrative that simply wasn't true. There was no proof Donna planned a murder. No evidence she hired anyone to commit it, and no sign that she ever wanted Dan Markell dead. And as far as motive, cornerstone of the state's case, Fulford told jurors they would see it wasn't a motive at all. The relocation battle was long over, and the divorce wasn't as contentious as the state represented it to be. The defense had witnesses ready to prove it. Even Donna's behavior after Dan's death, they argued, had a simple explanation, one that pointed somewhere else, not toward Donna. As the trial unfolded, Donna's attorneys, Jackie Fulford and Josh Zellman, promised jurors they would see her for who she truly was, a mother and a grandmother. Overbearing at times, yes, but never violent, and certainly never a mastermind. They told the jury Donna's story the way they wanted it heard. But would it be enough? Based on the testimony and the evidence they presented, this is the defense's story. To the prosecution, Donna Adelson was the architect of a murder plot. The defense, however, asked that the jurors take a second look. Donna wasn't some mob boss. She was a grandmother, one that had been married to Harvey for more than 50 years, worked for the family's dental practice, and devoted her life to her children and grandchildren. Her friends would describe her as kind and caring, maybe even to a fault at times. But according to the defense, that's not evidence of murder. That's simply her own flaw as a mother. Jurors had already seen Donna's words, emails and texts where she called Dan names like gibbers and jackass. Harsh words, ugly words, no doubt. But the defense said prosecutors twisted them into something they were never meant to be. They weren't the words of a killer. They were the words of a frustrated mother, venting during her daughter's divorce. It was late 2012 when Wendy filed for divorce, and like so many divorces, it was messy at times, emotional, but far from the bitter custody war prosecutors later described. For Donna, the hardest part of Wendy's divorce wasn't the pleadings or the hearings. It was the distance. Her grandsons were in Tallahassee. She was in Miami. Donna longed for Wendy and the boys to come home. In her mind, it made sense. Wendy could earn more in Miami, the boys would be tended to by their grandparents, and Dan, with a flexible schedule, could easily travel to visit. Every time the subject of relocation came up, Donna latched onto it. If Wendy could move back home, everything would be easier. When Wendy raised the idea of relocation with her attorney, Kristen Adamson, she was told it wasn't unusual. Plenty of parents wanted to move closer to family. But the law requires a judge's approval. And for that, there had to be proof the children would be harmed by staying put. Neglect, abuse, addiction, none of which applied. Adamson gave it a 50-50 chance of approval. In December, Wendy drafted the motion and sent it to Donna with a note. Here it is. Let's make edits. Donna encouraged her to make the relocation a non-negotiable and not back down. She even began looking at some dating profiles of single men in Miami for Wendy, just to show her life in Miami could be a fresh start. Family law isn't that simple, though, which is why, in June of 2013, the court denied relocation with prejudice. The matter was over, legally closed. And for Wendy, it was disappointing, but she stipulated to the denial and moved on. Donna, on the other hand, had no clue the motion had been denied with prejudice. She and Harvey were at the hearing that day, but were kept in the hallway as potential witnesses. The defense claimed Wendy never told Donna there wouldn't be an opportunity to try again. So Donna kept sending emails, pushing and pleading, convinced relocation was still on the table. She vented, complained about Dan, and sometimes she used harsh words, words she'd later hear repeated in the courtroom. To the prosecutors, those words became the motive. To Donna, they were nothing more than frustration. Adamson told jurors this wasn't unusual. Parents often leaned on family, and grandparents often voiced their frustrations. In fact, she even called Donna and Harvey lovely people. She never once saw them interfere in the legal work. After nearly 40 years in family law, Adamson knew what high conflict cases looked like. This, she said, wasn't one of them. Once the relocation was off the table, the divorce looked like any other. Financial issues, parenting schedules, and holiday swaps. After mediation, Dan and Wendy reached a financial settlement in July of 2013. When Dan didn't pay the full settlement amount he agreed to, which was about $80,000 short, he accused Wendy of hiding money, which he said breached the marital settlement. He filed personal, sometimes hostile, pleadings. Wendy's attorneys told jurors they were frivolous, nonsensical, even improper. Family law expert Linda Bailey reviewed the filings. She told jurors they weren't the makings of a bitter custody war. They were parenting squabbles, arguments over FaceTime calls, over who could watch the boys, and over Jewish holidays. Bailey even said many of Dan's motions wouldn't have carried weight in court at all. At one point, she scribbled in her notes, "Insert eye roll here." Even the so-called grandmother motion, accusing Donna of saying negative things about Dan in front of the boys, Bailey dismissed as trivial. In the end, both Adamson and Bailey told the same story. Dan Markell may have been difficult. Donna may have been frustrated. But this was a divorce that was settled, not a war or motive for murder. Donna never pretended she liked Dan, and her emails made that clear. But from Donna's point of view, her words weren't evidence of motive. They were a result of venting, the kind of harsh emotional shorthand people use when they feel helpless. Her anger was real, and her bitterness was undeniable. However, according to the defense, Donna's hostility ended with words. So Donna's anger wasn't motive. If the divorce was run-of-the-mill, the litigation closed, and the so-called grandmother motion was nothing more than trivial squabbling, then what was left? According to the state, plenty. They told jurors the evidence showed a conspiracy, a family plot that stretched from Miami to Tallahassee, a web of phone calls, coded words, and calculated actions that they said revealed Donna at the center of it all. The defense told jurors to take a closer look. These were ordinary conversations over everyday family decisions. The rhythm of a mother who talked to her kids constantly and was involved with her family, but nothing more. And so the question shifted from why Donna would want Dan Markell dead to whether she was ever involved in the plot at all. If prosecutors were right, Donna Adelson's fingerprints were all over the conspiracy. Her calls with Charlie, her coded language, even her name on Wendy's TV repair appointment the very morning Dan was shot. Donna had always been close to her family. However, with Wendy in Tallahassee and her oldest son Rob busy with his own life, Donna leaned more and more on Charlie. He wasn't just her son. He was her partner in the family business, her sounding board, the one she vented to when things got overwhelming, including Wendy's divorce. Donna said she was careful not to burden Wendy with her own stress, so she vented to Charlie and asked him to keep it between them. She relied on him for other things too, like planning Harvey's 70th birthday in July of 2014. While driving home from a visit to Tallahassee, Donna texted Charlie that she'd call him when they stopped and asked him to delete the message. 20 minutes later, she texted again, clarifying that she needed to talk about a gift for Harvey. Months later, when Charlie admitted he was still working on it, Donna reassured him it was a big milestone, but she knew he'd pull it off. And he did. Harvey's party was a lavish celebration, complete with paella cooked out on the balcony. The whole family was finally together. Wendy came down to Miami for more than a week. Rob and his family joined. And of course, Charlie was there too. It was the last big family gathering before Dan was murdered. While the state argued to jurors those birthday texts weren't about a gift at all, they were coded talk about murder, the defense pushed back. These weren't secret messages. They were exactly what they appeared to be. A mother and son planning a birthday surprise. And as for the Evite where the boy's last name showed up as Adelson instead of Markell, well, the defense asked jurors, can anyone even prove that Donna typed that? Or was it just another leap, another assumption the state wanted them to make? The same, they said, was true of the South Beach condo, which Donna and Harvey bought and had Wendy listed as a resident. The state claimed it was proof that Donna was laying the groundwork for Wendy's relocation after Dan was gone. However, Donna and Harvey said it was simply a weekend place. They just listed Wendy as a resident so she could come and go more easily. It was a secure building with a doorman and restricted access. And Donna simply wanted her daughter and grandsons to have a safe, hassle-free place to stay when they visited Miami. The defense even had an answer for the infamous TV repair appointment that was scheduled under Donna and Harvey's names for the day of Dan Markell's murder. Harvey had set up the appointment in an attempt to help Wendy out. The work order even allowed for an early appointment. hardly the mark of a carefully timed alibi. The defense said that Donna only forwarded the appointment to Wendy because she was trying to help, not orchestrating a cover for murder. Piece by piece, the defense told jurors this wasn't conspiracy. This was ordinary family behavior that had been misconstrued, exaggerated, and weaponized by the state. However, after Dan Markell was shot in his quiet neighborhood on July 18, 2014, ordinary excuses couldn't explain what happened next. That evening, just after 7 p.m., Donna was at home when her phone rang with a call from Wendy. She asked her mother, "Are you sitting down?" Jurors listened to a clip of a video of Wendy in an interview room at the Tallahassee Police Department, calling her parents after hours of questioning. A victim advocate sitting right beside Wendy testified that she couldn't hear Donna's exact words since the phone wasn't on speaker, but she could hear the reaction. And to her, Donna sounded like any other mother receiving devastating news. Upset, emotional, and blindsided. The defense asked, if Donna had been part of a murder plot, wouldn't she have been waiting for that call, ready for the moment? Instead, they said her reaction was pure shock. Donna's longtime friend, Ann Cunningham, echoed the same. She told jurors Donna called her in tears, saying Dan had been shot and she was going to Tallahassee to be there for Wendy. The state pointed out there was no call log for that, but Annie told jurors that sometimes Donna used apps like Viber, which would account for its absence in her phone history. Wendy asked Donna to tell Charlie about what happened. So Donna texted Charlie at 7:12 p.m. that night with an urgent message to call her. Within the hour, Donna and Harvey left South Beach, heading north. The plan was to stop in Orlando, then drive the rest of the way the next day. Prosecutors said this was the moment Donna and Harvey delivered the money. They pointed to a text Donna sent Charlie. It read, "I'm outside." To them, this was proof. She was at Charlie's, waiting to hand off the cash. But the defense claimed that text could mean anything. 20 minutes passed before Charlie finally texted back. 10 minutes. What about the timeline that the state showed court? The one showing that Donna and Harvey took nearly 2.5 hours to make a drive that should have taken just over one. To prosecutors, that gap was the payment drop-off. But to the defense, Donna and Harvey were older, slower travelers. Add in stops for food, gas, bathroom breaks. It wasn't unusual. And it certainly wasn't proof of a payoff. When Katie Mabanawa told jurors that Charlie said the money came from his parents, the defense reminded the jury of how unreliable Katie had been as a witness. After all, she had changed her story half a dozen times. Could they really trust her words? Even her detail about the money being stapled into stacks, that was something Charlie was known to do. Not Donna. The defense conceded there may be evidence that Charlie provided money. But, they said, that's where it ends. It doesn't stretch to Donna. And even Luis Rivera, the state's star witness, agreed. When talking to defense attorneys, he crossed Donna's name out of the conspiracy diagram. To him, the lady who wanted custody wasn't Donna. It was Wendy. For the defense, that was the point. The conspiracy existed, but Donna Adelson wasn't in it. Up to this point, Donna's defense had a simple rhythm. Deny the state's leaps, cast doubt on their theories, and remind jurors that suspicion is not the same as proof. However, once the trial's focus shifted to the money trail, the checks, the payments, the cash that prosecutors called the lifeblood of the conspiracy, Donna's story took a different turn. Donna was no longer denying accusations linking her to the money. Instead, she had a reasonable explanation. It wasn't a hired murder. It wasn't a conspiracy. The reason Donna Adelson and her defense team say she was paying people? Extortion. That was the defense's twist. The explanation, Donna said, made everything finally make sense. According to Donna, everything started when her son Charlie told her the family was being extorted. When Donna was still hoping for Wendy and the boys to relocate, they discussed offering Dan a $1 million incentive if he would allow it. And while it sounds shifty, the attorneys that testified for the defense said there's nothing legally wrong with this, and they've seen it happen in other situations. Things took a left turn when Charlie mentioned the $1 million incentive to Katie, who then told Sigfredo Garcia. Sigfredo and Luis Rivera decided that if the Adelsons were willing to offer Dan $1 million for custody of the boys, then the two of them should be awarded $1 million for taking matters into their own hands to win Wendy and her family custody. Charlie denied ever organizing the hit, stating that the men found Dan on their own, killed him, and then showed up at his doorstep demanding he pay up or else. Since Charlie, like most people, didn't carry $1 million in cash, he made arrangements with Katie to turn over what he had and pay her the rest over time. In Donna's mind, there was no other choice. She believed her son, so the deal was set. If it meant protecting her family, she would sign whatever she needed to. That's why the checks were in her handwriting. Not because she was bankrolling a murder for hire, it was because she thought she was buying her family's safety. To her, this wasn't a conspiracy. This was survival. And when this version of events finally came out years later during Charlie's 2023 trial, Donna's reaction was instant. She began texting friends. The truth is finally coming out. She even wrote Wendy, explaining that the lawyers had told them to keep the extortion story from her, to protect her from the burden of knowing. For Donna, this was the missing piece, the explanation for what prosecutors called a money trail. Not conspiracy, not payoff, extortion. For more than a year, the payments continued. Donna signed the checks, Charlie handed them off, and in her mind, the family was safe. It was the price of silence, the cost of keeping her daughter and grandsons out of danger. Everything was fine until that fragile sense of control shattered one afternoon in Miami, when a stranger approached Donna on the street. He knew her name, he knew her family, and he demanded more money. It was April 2016, nearly 2 years had passed since Dan Markell's murder. For Donna, life had fallen into a strange pattern. She signed checks, Charlie handed them off, and they all hoped that their family was safe. But one day, everything changed. Outside her Miami condo, a man appeared, a stranger. He handed Donna an envelope, and inside, a flyer. Dan Markell's name, a demand for $5,000, and a phone number scrawled at the bottom. Donna was terrified. She told the man, "You scared me." This moment would come to be known as the bump, a trap staged by the FBI to see how Donna would react and to get her talking on the phone so they could listen in on wiretaps. When Donna got into the safety of her home, she called Charlie. Donna told her son about the flyer she had just received, and she said, "It involves both of us." Now, to the state, those five words were a confession, an acknowledgement of their shared role in Dan's murder. But Donna's attorneys told the jury to see it differently. Through Donna's eyes, those words weren't an admission of guilt. They were the panicked response of a mother who had just been threatened. If the Adelsons were being extorted, as Charlie always told her, then of course it involved both of them. They were both being targeted. Donna's behavior after the bump, according to the defense, was the behavior of a woman who was scared for her life, scared for her family, and unsure of who else may be lurking around nearby. There were times afterwards when she talked in code, like when she said, quote, "The TV was about 5. But Donna was just confused, afraid, and not sure of what was happening. It wasn't a cover-up. It was fear. There were hours of wiretaps of Charlie and Donna talking, often in code. The defense explained all of these calls and their use of code words as Charlie just being chatty and Donna humoring him. And they definitely didn't think she should be held responsible for the things Charlie said on those recordings. To the defense, those calls told the story of a woman blindsided, frightened, and manipulated. Panicked? Yes. Reactive? Sure. But never in control. For years after the bump, Donna lived with the weight of it all. The fear, the silence, the belief that speaking out about the extortion would only make things worse. She kept it buried, tucked away inside her family. Then in 2022, everything shifted when Charlie was arrested. For the first time, the story Donna had been told, the extortion that she believed explained everything, would be aired in open court. Charlie took the stand, and with him came the defense's long-kept secret, extortion. The checks, the payments, the fear that had lingered for years. For Donna, it felt like relief. Finally, the truth was coming out. Finally, jurors would see the story as she saw it. She believed they would understand and that her son would walk free. However, that's not what happened. Jurors didn't buy Charlie's version of events. They convicted him of first-degree murder, conspiracy, and solicitation. Charlie was guilty on all counts. Donna was devastated. And in that moment, she said her world collapsed. Because if jurors didn't believe Charlie, why would they ever believe her? She texted Wendy saying, "You know I'm next." Her words reflected a spiral of fear. To prosecutors, they were an admission of guilt. To the defense, they were something far more human. The panicked words of a devastated mother, watching her son be led away in shackles and convinced the state would come for her too. She was exhausted, broken, and searching for escape. It was all becoming too much. She needed space. She needed air, a way to breathe. She just needed a moment of peace. Donna turned to a family friend, Richard Chagrin, a man who had traveled to 75 countries and knew the ins and outs of visas. Chagrin explained to jurors that he was the one who suggested one-way tickets to Vietnam, simply because Donna and Harvey didn't know exactly when they'd return. It could be cheaper and easier for them to book a flight home when they were ready. Donna also consulted her attorney, Maricel Descalzo, who testified that Donna had been told she was free to travel. Sure, there was talk of Vietnam being a non-extradition country, but Vietnam does extradite in some murder cases. This wasn't a getaway plan. Besides, Donna had every intention of returning for her grandson's bar mitzvah. Donna was merely running to escape the noise, pressure, and tension of a situation that gave her no space to breathe. She was just an exhausted grandmother trying to find peace. Unfortunately, running from your problems rarely works, and the storm Donna was trying to escape was only growing stronger. Donna was arrested at the gate moments before boarding her flight and charged with the murder of Dan Markell. From there, she was transferred to the Leon County Jail in Tallahassee, where she would remain until her trial. Life inside was miserable. The food, the conditions, the constant noise. It was a continuation of chaos she was trying to escape. Donna hated the way she was treated, but nevertheless tried to carve out some kind of routine and normalcy in a place designed to strip that away. So she did what many inmates do. She talked. She chatted with other women about their lives, about what had landed them behind bars, about the families they missed. She even thought she had made a few friends. Donna got to know women like Patricia Byrd and Drina Bernhardt, two women who had once been locked up with Katie McBanawah. But in jail, friendship can be a dangerous illusion because those women she confided in would later become witnesses for the state. Jailhouse informants, eager to tell prosecutors exactly what they wanted to hear in exchange for leniency. Patricia testified that Donna confessed her role in Dan Markell's murder, and Drina claimed Donna asked her to take the stand to say Katie had lied about Donna and Charlie's involvement. She even claimed Donna offered money, property, and dental veneers in exchange for her testimony, and that Donna had written out a script that she was supposed to say. It wasn't that simple in the defense's mind, though. They said these women weren't telling the truth. They were telling stories. Stories built on rumor, half-truths, and self-interest. Patricia and Drina filled Donna's ears with stories of Katie's history of manipulation. But that's only half of the story. The defense said the real truth was that those women were just as manipulative as they claimed Katie to be. Informants, after all, don't talk for free. They talk for deals. And the promise of leniency, a shorter sentence, or favor in their own cases was more than enough to make up a confession that prosecutors wanted to hear. And what about the so-called script Donna was accused of writing? The defense asked jurors to step back and think. That paper wasn't proof of guilt. It wasn't some blueprint of a murder-for-hire plot. It was the byproduct of manipulation. Donna, already frightened, already vulnerable, was pressured into putting things on paper, pressured by people who saw an opportunity to use her words against her. Two private investigators who interviewed the informants testified that not once did those women mention a confession from Donna. The defense warned the jury not to mistake ambition for truth. These weren't reliable narrators. They were opportunists, and their stories were no more credible than rumors traded in the prison yard. By the time the last witness stepped down, the jury had heard two very different stories: the prosecution's tale of a mother who plotted a murder, and Donna's story of fear, frustration, and family. Now, it was time for the defense to give their final word. As Jackie Fulford rose to face the jury one last time, she passionately reminded them that their task wasn't to decide whether Donna Adelson was a perfect mother or even a likable one for that matter. Their job was to decide if the state had proved, beyond a reasonable doubt, that she was guilty of conspiracy and murder. And in Fulford's words, they had not. She told the jurors the prosecution's case was built on anger, speculation, and spin. Donna said ugly things about Dan during a bitter divorce. She meddled, yes. She wanted her daughter and grandsons closer, yes. But none of that equated to murder. There were no emails, no texts, no recordings where Donna ever explicitly said she wanted Dan dead. There was not a single witness who could testify that Donna planned, plotted, or hired anyone. Donna's words were twisted into code, her emails into motive, her parenting frustrations into criminal intent. Fulford claimed that the evidence toward conspiracy ended with Charlie. He may have been the fixer. Katie may have been the go-between. Siegfriedo and Lewis may have been the killers, but that circle never included Donna. Even Lewis Rivera, the state's star witness, testified that Donna wasn't part of it. He literally crossed her name out of the conspiracy diagram. She reminded them that the checks Donna signed weren't blood money, but the price of extortion. And she asked them not to criminalize the panic of a mother who had already lost one child to prison. Fulford ended by reminding jurors that disliking your son-in-law is not a crime. Meddling in your daughter's life is not a crime. Being an overbearing grandmother is not a crime. But, Fulford said, convicting Donna Adelson without evidence, that would be. And with that, the case was in the hands of 12 strangers. The wait began. Minutes turned into hours, and not a peep from the jury room. Then, after just over 3 hours, word spread. A verdict had been reached. Court was called back into session. Donna Adelson sat alongside her attorneys at the defense table, her hands clasped tightly in front of her. Across the aisle, prosecutors leaned forward, and in the front row, Dan's family braced themselves, eyes fixed on the jurors as they filed in, their faces unreadable. The room was silent as the clerk handed the verdict slip to the judge, and every eye in the courtroom locked on that paper. Every breath held. The words about to be spoken would end a decade of speculation and seal Donna Adelson's fate. Justice, one way or another, was about to be decided.
It is in its proper order. At this time, I will publish the verdict. We, the jury, find as follows as to count one of the indictment, first-degree murder. The defendant is guilty of first-degree murder. Mrs. Adelson, control yourself.
As the final words of the verdict were delivered, guilty on all three counts, Donna Adelson crumbled. She cried out, shook her head, and shouted in disbelief. The scene grew so intense that the judge ordered the jurors out of the room during her emotional eruption. Despite the chaos, the verdict stood. Donna Adelson was guilty of first-degree murder, conspiracy, and solicitation. After the verdict, the courtroom turned to the family Dan had left behind. His parents, Ruth and Phil Markell, were given the opportunity to deliver their victim impact statements. Their words weren't about evidence or legal theories. They were about absence. They painted a portrait of loss that no trial could measure. They spoke about Dan as a son, a brother, and above all, a father. About two little boys who would grow up without his guidance. About birthdays, graduations, and milestones that would pass without him there. It was a moment that reminded everyone in the room, lawyers, media, the public, that behind every trial, behind every headline, there's a family left broken. For Ruth and Phil, the pain was not just in losing Dan. It was in how he was taken, ambushed in his own driveway, the victim of a plot that ripped through their family. They told the jury, and Donna Adelson herself, that the void left behind could never be filled. The trial had delivered justice, but it could never bring back the man whose life was stolen, and the ache of that loss would echo far beyond the courtroom walls. The verdict was in. Donna Adelson's fate had been decided. But as the Markells left the courtroom, one question lingered. What did the jurors feel in those moments? Next week, we'll step outside the jury box as I sit down with the jury foreperson for an extraordinary inside look at the deliberations. What swayed them, what surprised them, and how they saw Wendy's role. Plus, we'll look at the evidence the jury didn't get to hear. Because in every trial, there's the case the jury decides and the stories left untold. Like wiretaps of conversations between a jailhouse informant and Harvey Adelson. What Rob Adelson told prosecutors about his mother that jurors weren't allowed to hear. And information that was suppressed, details that were left out, and witnesses who never took the stand. Could those missing pieces change the way you see the case? Because the jury has spoken, but this story is far from over.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.